Good morning, everyone. It's 8 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time. We take you now to Bordeaux.
Hello, NBC. I'm Marshal Bedoglio, head of the Italian forces, in Italy's of South Veneto. We might recall that it was by intermediaries of the Spanish government that the French government entered into contact with the German government. Mr. La Querica, ambassador of Spain, communicated with General Benedetto, B-E-I-G-N-E-D-E-R, who at once transmitted to Chancellor Hitler the message of the French government. On the other hand, Monseigneur Valerio Valeri, the apostolic nuncio, accepted the established contact between the French government and the Italian government. Here in Bordeaux today, the Bordeaux that is today the capital of France, to say that people are stunned would be gross understatement. The present situation is so unprecedented in history. What the near future holds for France is so completely unimaginable and unpredictable that human comprehension fails. This is one of those hours in history when conventional word forms are quite inadequate. On the streets, everywhere, conversations begin, and then they are left hanging in mid-air. So, such is it, of course. People here who were in Czechoslovakia at the time of the Munich conference remarked the contrast between the quiet here today and the manifestations of public despair in Prague in September 1938. The explanation seems to be that people here have not yet been able to fully realize just what has happened. The ideal France for the great power, free and proud, is so fundamental a part of every Frenchman's existence. And it has been for so many centuries. But the idea of anything else escapes them. And then there is faith in an eternal sense that cannot be. In ordinary times, nationalism, feeling of country, is almost taken for granted. Today, the press is beginning to mirror nationality as that intangible thing aside from which all else is unimportant. One of the most eloquent phrases I have seen is in the Figaro this morning. It says, recent events have changed nothing, or almost nothing, in my work or in my habits. And hence, I have the strange feeling that I have become only a phantom of myself. The essential task today is to maintain order in the country. Strict measures have been taken to prevent the further dispersion of population. Already, it would seem, floods of refugees in many instances have seriously disorganized the work of the army while hampering supply columns of food and material from moving to the front by opening a pathway for German troops to advance behind them. The problem is so vast that a special portfolio for refugees has been given to Mr. Schumann in the Pétain cabinet. This is Bordeaux, returning to you to the National Broadcasting Company. We will be on the air again in 7 minutes. That ends your program.
You've just heard from Helen Hyatt, speaking from Bordeaux, France. This is the regular morning roundup of European news. Ladies and gentlemen, as Bordeaux starts on a time basis, apparently their clocks and ours were not in sync, which accounted for the abrupt switch to Bordeaux at 8 o'clock this morning. Here in the NBC newsroom in New York, we have this bulletin from Berlin. A German spokesman declared today that the battle in France continues, but capitulation practically has been carried out, as Adolf Hitler and Benito Mussolini sped to their momentous meeting on France's suite for peace. Another bulletin from Berlin. Adolf Hitler arrived in Munich today for a meeting with Premier Mussolini of Italy to discuss a peace with France. Next, this morning, we hear from the British capital. Go ahead, London.
This is London at about 5 minutes past one. Fred Bates speaking. Until terms have been announced as accepted or rejected, nothing can be added here to what is already known. It is reported that fighting in France continues and will continue until a settlement has been reached, or indefinitely if the terms are unacceptable. There has been no surrender, and Marshal Pétain has stated that only an honorable settlement can be accepted. The report that Herr Hitler and Signor Mussolini are meeting at Munich today should mean that very soon this whole question will be answered. Herr Hitler is said to have arrived at Munich about an hour ago. The dramatic announcement of Britain's offer of union to France was as tragic as it was dramatic. Under any other circumstances, writers would have dealt with the proposed near fusion of the Chamber of Deputies and the House of Commons in lighter vein. The nations of the British Empire are already forming new armies. France will keep her available forces in the field, on the sea, and in the air. In that single phrase is probably unconsciously expressed the tragedy of the whole suggestion. This union could not bring now what is needed to enable France to continue the unequal struggle, unequal in terms of equipment and material, but that story is old. This is not the first time that such a union has been heard of. Some listeners may remember that Charles Morgan, the author and playwright, proposed this early this year. He then asked that the two countries should formally announce themselves as the United Powers of France and Great Britain, or Les Puissances Unies de la Grande-Bretagne et de la France. At that time, early January, there was no response to his suggestion. This country is taking on the feeling of a place besieged. An English friend of mine writes, "It is at last dawning upon the English that they must rely upon themselves alone to withstand the Nazi attack, which they expect any moment to be launched upon them." I suppose, he says, that most of the English hope and even expect that America will be in this war as an ally before it is over. But they are realizing that during the coming weeks, even the material help America is giving, although it will increase, cannot do much to alter the balance of power. True, he says, some of the English turn a hopeful look toward Russia as a source of supply, and even as an ally to attack Germany in the East. The Evening Standard had a leader page yesterday urging the British to get on good terms with Russia. But not many expect anything to come of the present diplomatic approach to that country. Most of the press correspondents from the east of Europe emphasize that Russia is seeking only to insulate herself. So the English see that they must help themselves, and there is a growing demand for a people's army. Every man of military age to be given rudimentary training in a rifle and hand grenades. Captain Little Hart, in yesterday's press, warns against rash action. It is not quantity, in his opinion, that will hold up the enemy, but quality, or rather sufficient quantity of quality. The French had 5 million men mobilized and were broken up by a German force of around 2 million. In this morning's News Chronicle, Mr. Horobin, the Liberal MP, puts his argument in favor of the arming of the whole people. He quotes Ludendorff's A People's War, blazing up all over the country, will eventually prevent the victor from reaping the full fruits of his victory. Mr. Horobin pictures scattered German attacks over the entire country from air and sea, so that the army would have to be broken up into far too small units to cope with such invasion, and says the only defense, as was proved in Spain, is to arm the whole people. If rifles and guns are not available, hand grenades could be. Such an army, he says, could be organized within a week. A reliable report in London states that the Soviet Union is expected within the next few days to make new demands on Finland. These demands, according to this report, are likely to concern the Åland Islands, which lie at the mouth of the Gulf of Bosnia and are of great strategic importance. At the time of the Russo-Finnish War, Finland took steps to fortify these islands. But their plan was never carried out, and today they are undefended. It is generally believed here that neither Finland nor Sweden would try to prevent the Russians from fortifying those islands. London completed its new evacuation scheme today. Altogether, about 105,000 children have been taken to safe areas in the past 6 days, but there are still more than 340,000 left.
This is NBC New York. You've just heard the report from London. We are informed that Bordeaux is ready to report again, so we take you now to Bordeaux.
Because we're waiting, of course, for the news of German conditions of peace. There's nothing else to do but wait. Speculation, naturally, is right. There's nothing certain, nothing that can be broadcast. All we know is that Hitler is conferring today with Mussolini. That Mussolini is accompanied by Count Jarno and Marshal Badoglio, that they are conferring in a village in the south of Germany. Perhaps we shall have news later, or tomorrow, as to what the peace terms will be. To say that people in France are stunned by the news of yesterday would be gross understatement. The present situation is so unprecedented in history. What the near future holds for France is so completely unpredicted that human comprehension fades. This is one of those hours in history when conventional word forms are quite inadequate. On the streets, in cafes, everywhere around us, you see people standing, you hear conversations begin, and then they're left hanging in midair. So what is there to say? People here, who were in Czechoslovakia at the time of the movie conference, remarked the contrast between the quiet here in Bordeaux today and the manifestations of public despair that took place in Prague in September 1938. The explanation of this seems to be that people here have not been able yet to fully realize just what has happened. For them, the idea of France as a great power free and proud, is so fundamental a part of every Frenchman's existence, and it has been for so many centuries, that the idea of anything else quite escapes them. You can't conceive of it. And yet another explanation of this lack of public manifestations of despair is something that may be inconceivable to you, and yet it is understandable here. It's a feast that France cannot know. In ordinary times, nationalism, the feeling of country, patriotism, is almost taken for granted. Today it's very different. Today the press here is beginning to mirror nationality as that intangible thing aside from which all else is unimportant. One of the most eloquent phrases I have seen is in the Figaro this morning. It says, and it's written by a man, a member of the French Academy, it says, recent events have changed almost nothing in my work or in my habits, and yet I have the same feeling that I am only the phantom of myself. Today, of course, the essential task here in France is to maintain order in the country. Every newspaper stresses it this morning. Such measures have already been taken to prevent the further displacement of population. And already, it would seem, floods of refugees in many instances have seriously disorganized, have almost disastrously hampered the work of the army. They've hampered it by interrupting supply columns of food and materials that were moving up to the front and were needed there. They've also hampered by opening, in many cases, a pathway for German troops to advance behind them. The problem of refugees is so vast that, as you know, a special portfolio for refugees has been given to Monsieur Schumann in the new State Department cabinet on Sunday night. This new minister for refugees today estimates their present number at 6 million of people. 6 million of people who have left their home and who will have, in some way or another, to at least try to get back to their homes again. The radio this morning called these people and told the other people in France not to leave their foyer, not to leave their home, because it said it is around these homes that first is this. The word for order in all the press today is that this is not the hour for polemic. One newspaper says that this is not, quote, the hour for political parties. It is the hour for leaders, unquote. And the Figaro says that we are today at one of the most tragic hours of our history. We owe this to the mortal clay of ideas and of persons, a mortal clay that is called politics, unquote. Further than this, of course, no press comment can go. The Catholic ministry is being held this morning at 11 o'clock under Marshal Pétain. There is still no communique. And so, as I say, we continue to wait. Wait for the news that is inevitable, and yet that people don't want to believe until it finally comes. This is NBC in Bordeaux, calling New York, returning you to New York. We will be on the line again with our regular program at 1750 to 1755 GMT, then 2325, 2330, 0205, 0210, and 0400 to 0408.
This morning we've had two summations from Bordeaux, France, and Fred Bates speaking from London. Now for the news on the home front by Earl Godwin, reporting from the NBC newsroom in Washington.
Good morning. And just having approved and provided for the biggest Navy ever in our history, our government starts another Navy program to make it the biggest Navy in the world. Another $1.2 billion Navy program gets underway this morning about 10 o'clock with the Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Stark, explaining the program to a congressional committee. It looks like a two-ocean Navy, but it will take months to plan, years to build. Meantime, only one canal between the two oceans, one canal in which only one bomb could stop traffic. And there's much talk in Washington, and the essence of yesterday's confabs is the world-sized scheme to fix things so that the aggressor nations cannot deal with the Western Hemisphere in those surpluses of food and minerals which now pile up in vast heaps, cause international headaches, and bring nations to the verge of economic war in trade competition. In other words, this great big economic war you read about and hear about today is a White House plan to organize the republics of North, South, and Central America into one grand storehouse for its own surpluses, to put a dictator, no less, on top of that heap, a dictator who can say, yes, you can ship this stuff to Europe, or no, you can't. This is designed to keep post-war, dead-broke Europe from trading with South America on any terms but ours. Well, it's a whale of a scheme, and just now it has only reached the talk and conference stage. It must be okayed here first by President Roosevelt and submitted to the Latin Americas, who right now, to speak frankly, cannot be counted on to give three heartfelt rousing cheers for everything this country suggests. Reason: they are being bombarded by and infiltrated with German good relations and trade. Also, we are in a row with Argentina over beef at this minute. We are at grips with Mexico over the Mexican seizure of American oil properties. American farm leaders, if they're on the proper political ground, will view with grave alarm any time any South American wheat, cattle, or corn comes into this country, and they are at work all the time to keep all South American products out. So the scheme to put the Western Hemisphere's surplus products into one jar and put that jar on the shelf and let somebody say just who will get it and under what conditions is still a one day's wonder. At the same time, it may become the Western world's last weapon against European totalitarian governments. This nation is well on its way to refuse to recognize and to stop, if necessary, the transfer of French territory in this hemisphere to Germany or anyone else. The Senate has adopted unanimously the Monroe Doctrine resolution, and the House is sure to pass it also. There are two small French islands off the Canadian coast. Great spots for rum runners in the bootleg era, if you will recall. Also, there's other property around the Caribbean. And this government's policy now seems to be to get the jump on Europe and stop a grab before it occurs. The famous short of war aid to the Allies is now aid to Britain, it can be assumed, because the vast amount of supplies that have been ordered in the United States by the French can be expected to be purchased by the British. And all this has put the idea of adjournment of Congress into the discard. Their only question now remaining before Congress is whether Congress should recess until both Republican and Democratic National Conventions are over, or for 1 week each. The administration proposes a recess through both political meetings. That would be next week for the Republicans and the week of July 15th for the Democrats. Yet there's opposition to any plan to take Congress away from Washington for more than a few days running in the light of chaotic world conditions. The folks back home insist that Congress remain here on the job. Earl Godwin says goodbye. That's all from Washington at this time.
This is NBC New York. You've just heard NBC's regular morning roundup of news from world capitals. This morning we had broadcasts from Bordeaux, from London, and just concluded the report from Washington. Over most of these stations at 1:45 this afternoon, NBC will bring you another roundup of European news. First, the report from Berlin, and as you probably heard Helen Hyatt say from Bordeaux, she would report at 17:50 GMT, which is Greenwich Meridian Time. That would be 1:50 this afternoon, Eastern Daylight Saving Time. That is a scheduled report, but of course NBC is constantly standing by and will bring you latest developments as they are transmitted from France. Keep tuned to this station for the latest word of the rapidly occurring events in Europe. This is the National Broadcasting Company.
It's 10 o'clock Eastern Daylight Time, and here in the NBC newsroom in New York is Mr. T.R. Ibarra, noted foreign correspondent, ready to bring you his nightly review of the day's news. During the course of Mr. Ibarra's broadcast, our engineers will be listening for Bordeaux. Some of our listeners may have heard our NBC reporter in the temporary French capital schedule a report for 5 minutes past 10 p.m. Eastern Daylight Saving Time in his earlier broadcast today. So as soon as we hear Bordeaux, we'll interrupt Mr. Ibarra and switch you to our reporter in that city. All right, Mr. T.R. Ibarra.
125 years ago today, on the 18th of June, 1915, the Battle of Waterloo was fought. On that celebrated Belgian battlefield, the France of Napoleon Bonaparte met final and crushing defeat. On this 18th of June, 1940, Adolf Hitler and Benito Mussolini, the victorious dictators of Berlin and Rome, are meeting in Munich to decide on the terms of peace to be offered to the France of 1940. That France has just been vanquished by Hitler in a series of battles of a scope, fury, and significance that dwarfed the great battle of 125 years ago. And there is excellent reason for assuming tonight that the terms about to be offered by Hitler and Mussolini to the beaten French government will be infinitely harsher than those imposed by the victors of Waterloo on the France of 1815. Of course, everything written tonight as to the exact nature of the peace conditions of the German and Italian dictators runs up against a rock. That rock is the fact that nobody is in a position to say just what those conditions will be, no matter how gaudily ignorance is dressed up to resemble knowledge. It is possible that Hitler and Mussolini themselves have not reached final decision. There may still be points on which further discussion and bargaining between them will be necessary. Nevertheless, in spite of the fog enveloping the Brown House at Munich, sacred headquarters of Nazism, where Der Führer and Il Duce met today, all signs point to the probability that the peace cooked up by them will be a peace of vengeance. Even if Hitler wanted to be magnanimous, and he has given no clear signs of any such desire, he would find immense obstacles in his path. In Germany, millions of Germans are wild for revenge. These irreconcilable Teutons have not forgotten the shattering victory of the Allies over Germany in the World War. They remember the crushing clauses of the Treaty of Versailles, imposed upon Germany in 1919 after the collapse of the Kaiser's armies in 1918. All those Germans remember the famous sleeping car of Compiègne. In that car, Marshal Foch placed before Germany's special envoys the hard terms upon which he was willing to accept an armistice. All these things German diehards remember. And there is practically no reason why Hitler should not be classed among those diehards. The Führer has been shouting for years that his mission is to obliterate every vestige of the Europe created by the Treaty of Versailles. Tonight, after weeks of victories over French armies that have left France prostrate at Nazi Germany's feet, it seems incredible that the nemesis of Versailles should suddenly turn into a lamb of forgiveness and mercy. Moreover, Benito Mussolini sits at Adolf Hitler's elbow tonight. Ever since Il Duce seized power, he has bitterly lamented the fact that fascist Italy is, to use his own expressive phrase, the prisoner of the Mediterranean. Only by the defeat of France and Britain can Mussolini drastically alter the Mediterranean situation. Britain, of course, remains to be pushed out of his way, but France has been struck down. It simply doesn't make sense to visualize Mussolini as eating the words of scores of his fiery speeches. One cannot see Il Duce foregoing the opportunity of driving away the French from the vantage points that have enabled France up to now to make the Mediterranean a prison for Italians. Hitler, one may reasonably guess, will insist on reducing his French foes to military impotence. The Nazi dictator will probably also demand that France turn over the French navy to those who have just vanquished her, a demand in which he will be vigorously seconded by Mussolini. Whether the French fleet will let itself be caught by Germany and Italy is another matter. Hitler will also probably seek to impose a heavy indemnity on stricken France. As to territorial demands, he will doubtless seek to recover for Germany Alsace and Lorraine, taken from France by Germany in 1871 and from Germany by France in 1919. As for colonies, the Nazis will doubtless try to snatch from France all German colonial possessions wrested by the French from the Germans after the World War, and more French colonies besides. All these demands would be in the true Versailles manner. Just to make them even more bitter to the French, they may be imposed on the vanquished French Republic at Versailles itself, possibly with a preliminary armistice signed at Compiègne, possibly in the very sleeping car, preserved there as a sacred French shrine.
Excuse us, Mystery Barrow. I think we have our signal from Bordeaux. Let's try it overseas to Bordeaux.
Calling NBC New York. Bordeaux. Calling NBC New York. Bordeaux. Calling NBC New York. This is John Lloyd of the Associated Press tracking. The Associated Press Emergency Bureau at Bordeaux sent a dispatch during the day saying the French government was awaiting an answer to Marshal Pétain's request for an honorable peace. At 3 o'clock in the morning, our time here in Bordeaux, there was still no news of a reply. It may be a matter of only hours, and it may be days. In the meantime, until an agreement has been reached, the French troops are continuing their resistance. In Bordeaux, whose population has been swelled to proportion out of all relation with facilities, thousands of people are sleeping in their cars, parked in squares, on the streets, on lots. Most of these people have trekked hundreds of miles. The cars are crammed with personal belongings. The sleepers squeeze in wherever they can. In the daytime, the sidewalks are so jammed, many have to walk in the streets. Traffic is so heavy that it's almost impossible to get by car from one part of the city to another. Yet, in this almost incredible situation, there has been no sign of disorder. People are taking it well, all things considered. All British soldiers, except a few stragglers, have now left. This includes newspaper men and diplomats. There's still a large representation of American newspaper correspondents here, most of whom probably will stay on for whatever happens. And Ambassador Biddle is remaining in contact with the government. Embassy Secretaries Freeman Matthews and Douglas MacArthur Jr. are also here. Captain John Sterling, the air attaché, and Captain Robert Scow, acting military attaché, are also on the job. They all fought at the American consulate, which has a huge American flag outside. The embassy attaché is like the newspaper men moved with the government from Paris to Tours. Then they came on here. Tours was like Bordeaux, teeming with huge crowds of refugees. It was almost as hard there as it is here to find a place to sleep and find a restaurant where you could get something to eat. I recall one day at Tours when Captain Stown, Captain Sterling, and my A.P. colleague, Bill McGafflin, and I were turned away for other restaurants we visited in Tours. Everywhere it was the same story, nothing left to eat. Finally, we bought ourselves some bread and tea and ordered at a table in a crowded cafe. This is the kind of gypsy life. You move on from one spot to another, constantly going. That is, constantly since we left town. Perhaps this is the last stop. Everybody has been dependent on cars. Relics that you would never imagine could run are to be seen on the packed and jammed road. Whole families are heaped into them. Families that have come perhaps from Belgium, perhaps from Paris, perhaps only from Tours. They're really disgusting, isn't it? One woman came into our office today and said she had to get to the Spanish border. She said it meant her life if she didn't get out. She had a brand new car, but she couldn't drive. She would give us the car at the border, she said, if only some one of us would drive her down. We couldn't help her. She trudged on out, red-eyed, and I don't know whether she found the driver or not. My fellow IP correspondents and I took turns sleeping in our two cars for the first couple of nights. We finally got a room, and our sleeping room by relays. There was an alert last night, and some anti-aircraft fire, but no bombs were heard. It was my first night in a room, and Taylor Henry, who shared it with me, on this, the second relay, was as tired as I. The siren sounded, but we went all off to sleep. That sounds like not the thing a newspaper correspondent should do. But you don't know how tired we were. And besides, AP correspondent Bill Humphrey was staying up to cover. Well, that is the story. Here we are. Here we will stay so long as there is news. When there isn't any anymore, we'll move on to where it all is. Good night.
Back in the NBC newsroom in New York, after we returned from overseas and from a report on the war situation from Bordeaux by John Lloyd, member of the Associated Press Emergency Bureau in the temporary French capital. We had interrupted Mr. T.R.E. Barra in his comments on the war situation to go overseas for this broadcast from Bordeaux, and perhaps you might be interested to know in passing that we weren't any too sure that we would have it, but that an earlier broadcast by our NBC reporter, Paul Archinard, this afternoon indicated he hoped to be on from Bordeaux at this time. Due to the temporary nature of our communications overseas, we are unable to give them a signal when to go ahead, so we switched over hopefully, and we were grateful to receive the broadcast from Mr. Lloyd. And now I return to Mr. Ibarra here in the NBC newsroom.
Hints come out of Europe tonight that France is by no means done for. Certain omens in the dark skies over Europe make it appear that the French are not yet out of the ring in the European war, despite the awful catastrophe that has overwhelmed their armies during the past 6 weeks. First, there is always the chance that the peace terms offered by Hitler and Mussolini to Marshal Pétain, head of France's government of capitulation, will be so hard as to make acceptance impossible. Pétain is on record as desiring a peace without dishonor. The old hero of Verdun may spurn another Versailles. That would make the war go on in France. Second, bellicose Prime Minister Winston Churchill of Britain spoke today in the House of Commons as if France might again be found fighting beside the British. Churchill's speech was in the nature of a warning to all Frenchmen who wish to give up. France's government, said Churchill, will be throwing away great opportunities and casting away their future if they do not continue the war in accordance with their treaty obligations, from which we have not felt able to release them. Churchill pointed out that a number of countries overrun by the Germans have never accepted Nazi conquest, that they maintain their legally constituted governments on foreign soil. Among these, Churchill included Czechoslovakia, Poland, Norway, Holland, and Belgium. If final victory rewards our trials, the fiery Englishman continued, France will share in the gains and freedom will be restored to all. If we fail, then the whole world, including the United States, and all we have known and cared for, will sink into the abyss of a new dark age. That was certainly a strong hint to France. Third, there are elements in France which disapprove of the policy of surrender adopted when Marshal Pétain replaced Monsieur Reynaud as head of the French government. Reynaud said a few days ago that the French government might be transferred to some French colony, from which the fight against Germany might be continued. Such a step is still a possibility, though a slender one. If such a French government in exile should be set up, it would doubtless claim to be the only legal French government. It would doubtless disavow surrender to Germany by any other French government, and thus strip from such a surrender the semblance of legality. There may be something behind these hints out of Europe tonight, but it must be stated right away that they carry little reassurance. France, after all, has just taken a terrible beating. When General Weygand became commander-in-chief of the Allied armies in France, after the French situation had become almost desperate, he immediately had a close friend of his, which is equivalent to saying a military man of high efficiency, made head of the French military cabinet in the now-defunct Reynaud government of France. That man was General de Gaulle. Tonight, de Gaulle joins the ranks of those Frenchmen who refuse to give up hope of further resistance.
Thank you, Mr. Ibarra. T.R. Ibarra, noted foreign correspondent in a review of today's news, and also a newscast by NBC's war reporter in Bordeaux. More news on WJZ. This is the National Broadcasting Company.